This is an ABC podcast.
This is Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. The world is witnessing a rollback of human rights. Amnesty International reports crimes against humanity and war crimes from Myanmar to Iraq have gone largely ignored. Worldwide, there are more than 25 million refugees. Half are children and teenagers. Nearly all have lived through torture and trauma. These experiences may taint their whole lives, affecting their mental health and well-being. In the face of this global refugee crisis, leaders of wealthy countries like the United States and Australia continue a hardline approach. Australia's offshore detention policy has been repeatedly criticised as cruel. Yet Australia is a world leader in delivering assistance to survivors of torture and trauma. RN's Cathy Van Exstel speaks to a panel of experts about attitudes to torture, the trauma many refugees have suffered, and what can be done to help them. Here are Raymond Gaita, Vicky Reynolds, Robert Mukambuzi, and Paris Aristotle.
Now, I'd like to start with you, Paris. The figures bounce around from year to year, but Australia takes in roughly 18,000 people under the Refugee and Humanitarian Program. Most have suffered trauma. What proportion of them are victims of torture?
It's a good question, and it's not a straightforward answer. But to be defined as a refugee, and certainly to be selected for resettlement, given that UNHCR are really only recommending people in urgent need for resettlement, you pretty much have to have had a history of persecution, trauma, and, as we know, in many cases, torture, even to kind of make it into that group for resettlement. So it's quite a high proportion, and it often depends on the nature of which particular community group is coming. But on average, over the last 30 years that I've been doing this work, I would still put the proportion of people that may have had a severe experience of torture, being detained systematically, individually tortured and brutalised, or having witnessed or been subject to homes and villages and towns being raided by military and watching family, friends be tortured or killed or whatever. At that extreme end of the spectrum, it can be up to about 30% of people that we bring into the country. But when you think about that concept of trauma and the nature of the refugee experience, then you're really talking about a further 50% or 60% or so that will have been through perhaps less severe on the surface experiences of trauma, but nevertheless been subject to traumatic experiences in violent circumstances. So the figures are actually quite high. Having said that, I want to qualify it by also saying the reason why we're called Victorian Foundation for Survivors of Torture is that people are remarkable in terms of their capability to survive and their courage. And where people may be struggling as a result of those experiences, we've talked about it as being very sane reactions to insane events, the insanity of war, the brutality of people pursuing power at all costs and so forth, is a problem and an abhorrence that they are responsible for. The survivors of torture and trauma, in fact, and refugees are quite remarkable, resilient and courageous people, and that's the basis on which we should be thinking about people from those backgrounds.
Absolutely, and I'm keen to explore that in this conversation today. I'm just wondering, though, according to Amnesty International, torture is not just alive and well, it's flourishing in many parts of the world. Is it a trend that you're seeing reflected in those that come here? Is it reflected on the sort of pressures in the system?
It really depends on how you're characterising it. So when I started in this space 30 years ago, a lot of the clients that we worked with were from Central and South America, mm-hmm. where there was a lot of the structure of the persecution was often to detain people, to brutalise and torture them systematically over a period of time, and deliberately to place them back out into the community as a kind of living example of what would happen if you opposed the regime. Some countries like back then, like Guatemala, didn't necessarily let people live, but people in the community would find mutilated bodies and so forth in the streets and that. That was a very determined, systematic process of imprisonment, detention, and systematic torture. And then you would have in other conflicts, so in the former Yugoslavia, for example, it was really the randomness with which military groups moved through villages and towns and would, in the open, not necessarily imprison and detain, but torture and brutalise and execute people in front of others in the local community. So the nature of it takes different shapes and different forms. But the interesting thing is that there's also a common sort of science to it as well. So in South America, Falanga is beating the soles of the feet with an iron bar. It's called Falanga in another part of the world. The different positions that people would be suspended in are the same in different parts of the world. And then the regimes become creative depending on what's available to them in order to inflict that pain. So for me, I'm not necessarily seeing it increasing. I think it's been at a very high level for a very long period of time. And the differences tend to be in the way in which governments try to cover it up or deal with it on the basis of ethnic cleansing and those kinds of concepts.
Vicky, I want to bring you in here. What we are seeing is more governments seeking to justify torture in the name of national security. Mm-hmm. The US and its allies, Canada and Australia amongst them, have of course been involved in conflict in the name of democratic freedom and values. Yet we have this inherent contradiction in the active or at least the tacit support of torture.
I guess what I would say is what I'm concerned about is that I remember being the clinical supervisor at the Center for Survivors of Torture in Vancouver 25 years ago, and I still have the newspaper that said the case for torture, and it terrifies me and makes me shake to this day. It was unfathomable to us in the campaign against torture with Amnesty International, which is the organizing group that our organization came from, direct activism. It was unthinkable that any government would ever make a case for torture. You know, and that was unbelievable. We were not strategizing for that. You know, we weren't organizing around that. And so for me, it's not just governments that are at peril. Governments are also responding to populism, and people are buying this and it's being sold to them. You know, and I think we underestimate how much governments might be reflecting white supremacy, racism, and fascism in our countries. So for me, that's what's really at the core. I know in the fight against the death penalty in the United States, that's a lot of the battle I was involved in before work with torture. All of the lawyers' strategies were to try to get the laws better. But I was like, we actually have to change, because what ended up happening is we got research that said actually finding the innocent man wasn't going to fix it, and that Americans could handle executing the innocent. And in fact, one of the cases I worked on, the man was executed under a statute that said the right to execute the innocent. So I think, you know, we have to be real about what has to move. It's not just governments and legislation and international bodies. We actually have to have real conversations about torture as something that we have brought back to common language as if it's something that now we can have debates about. You know, the conversation in the States around the death penalty ended up being what is the best way to kill somebody, not whether or not you should kill somebody. And we watch that happen. We ignore other parallel struggles in solidarity to our peril. You know, like, we are required to pay attention to this. So I'm really concerned about how many people actually think torture is a reasonable thing to discuss, which 2 decades ago that was unfathomable.
Ray Gaita, can I bring you in here as a philosopher? Should we even be discussing this?
I think that's a very interesting question. I started thinking about torture when discussion in Western democracies started about whether it could be justified or not. I was prompted to write something about it originally because there was an article in the Melbourne Age by then the Dean of Deakin Law School. He was what's in philosophy called a consequentialist, that is, he believes that the moral value of something depends entirely upon its consequences. There are a lot of people who are not consequentialists, though, who nonetheless take consequences so seriously that they would favour torture.
But what struck, this is the ticking bomb scenario.
It was a ticking bomb scenario, but what struck me as interesting about it was, his name was Mirko Bagaric. He used an expression, he said, torture is an excellent information gathering device. And a lot of people were outraged by this, and in fact so much that people called for his sacking from law school. And they were partly outraged that he could be so tone deaf as to use that phrase. And I started writing about it partly to try to capture the kind of shock that people exhibited when they read this. I think it had to do with the idea that we thought of ourselves, or that these people anyway thought of themselves, as belonging to a society in which torture was undiscussable. And societies are partly defined by what is undiscussable in them, whereas, as Vicky quite rightly said, we think there is no case for it. Let's take a less dramatic example. In Australia, nobody thinks that on the balance we should not assassinate our politicians. It's just not on. Nobody thinks of it. It's undiscussable. And people have thought that about torture. But what struck me as interesting is it didn't take very long for what had been essentially the expression of moral horror, for people to lose confidence in that and argue the practical line, that anyway it doesn't work and we'll degrade our institutions and so on. And that happened very, very quickly. And I was interested once when I was at a conference and I heard the professor of, was then the professor of jurisprudence at Oxford, Finnis, say that he had a student working on torture, and she had written in her PhD that the only articles by philosophers that she could come across that defended an absolute prohibition were Catholic philosophers. That didn't surprise me, actually, because though I read lots of philosophers who were hostile to thinking it's only the consequences matter, that you have to capture the evil of torture in some other way, and nonetheless, they thought, though it was an evil, a terrible thing always to do, no exceptions, nonetheless, you might be morally obliged to do it. The other interesting thing about it was the discussion was mostly about saving lives. One of the things I wondered was, why were we such a craven society? You know, that given how unlikely it was to be that we would be killed by terrorists, that we were prepared to turn all our values upside down, including arguing now whether torture should be permissible, for the sake of saving our lives. I remember when the hijacking of the plane started in the 70s, the hijackers would always demand the release of this person or that much money. And there was a debate whether you should or whether you shouldn't. A friend of mine said, he said, you know what we should do? We should become, as it were, conscripts, in civilian conscripts, in a war here against terror, where we say, what was called a war against terror, where we say, have a compact, as it were, a different kind of coalition of the willing, saying, if we're on a plane that's hijacked, don't rescue us. And I thought, I do remember when I wrote about this, someone said, Gator must be quite an old man to recommend something like that. But I felt the same thing about torture. Why could we not be a society which implicitly said to our leaders, for goodness sake, you know you're prepared to send us to war for something that might genuinely be a national security, and we might die in our thousands. Why are you now prepared to turn all our values up, make us accomplices to torture, turn over what had been unthinkable for the sake of... For the sake, just so that we can live. But could I just say, if there were something that was genuinely called a national emergency, that is, where it wasn't a matter of saving lives, but genuinely a matter of preserving the conditions under which a distinctive people can preserve their national identity or whatever, then the argument would be of a different kind altogether.
You're with Paul Barclay on RN, and this is Big Ideas. Broadcast, podcast, and on the ABC Listen app.
What encompasses torture is it possible to rebuild trust? On this panel are Raymond Gaita, Vicky Reynolds, Robert Mukumbozi, and Paris Aristotle. Moderator is RN's Cathy Van Extel.
In 2017, Australia finally ratified the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture, which was 8 years after actually signing the treaty. So what it means now is that there's independent oversight of our prisons, immigration detention centres and psychiatric facilities, but not our offshore detention centres. Paris Aristotle, in 2012, you were on Julia Gillard's Prime Ministerial Expert Panel on Asylum Seekers, one of the architects of the original offshore processing system. Now, I know that you've said that what we have wasn't at all what was recommended and that you've called for Manus and Nauru to be shut down. There is a view, though, including from the UN, that Australia is in breach of conventions around torture and punishment through our offshore processing. Do you agree?
Look, it's an interesting area of debate, and part of it stems with where you draw the line between torture or cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment. And what we've been struggling with is sometimes because people feel so distressed by what's happening for very good reason, in order to make the strongest case possible that it should shut, that they should be closed, people talk about it in terms of this is torture. And the problem we have is that the convention is the Convention Against Torture, Cruel, Inhuman and Degrading Treatment. And you don't have to be committing torture in order to be in violation of the convention, because cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment is considered as terrible and as bad regardless. What happens is there can be a tendency to overreach and leap straight to making the argument that this is actually torture, which then becomes very easy to get dismissed. And when it gets dismissed, all of the other incredibly valid and almost evidenced concerns that people legitimately hold, and in many cases have proven, also tend to get dismissed with it. So I'm not in the group that says this is the same as torture, but I don't think it has to be in order for us to say what's being done and how it's being managed and applied is okay. And when we, in 2012, when we made the recommendations, it wasn't about offshore processing, it was about building a regional set of arrangements that could protect hundreds of thousands or millions of people, and that Nauru and Manus were stepping stones to that with very clear safeguards that were compliance with human rights, no arbitrary detention, adequate and appropriate accommodation and housing, good quality health care and mental health services, vocational training, employment, education services, case management services, legal assistance to prepare your claims, and oversight mechanisms to make sure that that was being done properly. As soon as you start to say, well, actually, we're going to detain people, you have to employ 1,500 guards, all on penalty rates, all rotating through. And so instead of spending a reasonable amount of money taking care of people, processing their claims, preparing them through education and training and so forth for where they're going to be resettled and rebuild their lives in a timely manner, we ended up, because we weren't able to get the agreement in the parliament for all of the legislation necessary to do this, with governments retreating to fairly desperate attempts at using it as a form of deterrence. And as a form of deterrence, we were very clear, it never works. The only thing is that it guarantees is that it will cause deterrence is punitive. In these contexts, when you apply punitive policies and measures, you inevitably, no matter what you think, are going to harm people.
And picking up on that issue around harm, we're not only harming, Vicky Reynolds, refugees and asylum seekers on Manus and Nauru. There are asylum seekers and refugees in Australia who have uncertainty. I want to go to a refugee who suffered torture, who you've collaborated with. Tell us about Bauman.
So Bauman is a survivor of torture from Iran. He was tortured horrifically for 7 years in a prison there and escaped and got to Canada and then was able to see me at the Survivor of Torture Center.
So you collaborated, and he's a poet. He has a poem that he's written that really goes to the terror that he experienced through the refugee process. It's called Sitting and Waiting. I wonder if you could share that with us.
The thing for Bauman is, and this is what's an existential problem with this, when we look at it from a legal perspective, it's like the torture event end. Torture never ends. It's kind of like the story I told this morning, the Chilean woman whose children had disappeared. Pinochet in jail, Pinochet's dictatorship's over, her children are still disappeared. So there's a fluidity of time. And so for Bauman, he never felt any safety being in Canada because he lost his first try to get his refugee status. And he was saying that there's this fluidity of time. For him, there wasn't a time of safety in Canada, right? And so I think that we obscured more than we revealed by saying, oh, now he's in Canada, because for him that wasn't true. So I'm really interested in people's acts of resistance, not the torture story, but the person's story of resistance. And he said to me, oh, Victoria, would it be okay if I wrote you a series of resistance poems? To which I said, yes, do this. So this was one of the first poems that he wrote for me, but it was about what was going on for him in Canada. And it brought great waves of shame for me as a Canadian. Sitting and waiting. Sitting and waiting in the line of a slap when your hands are tied, standing in front of waves of accusation while your mouth is shut and the eyes which are blindfolded with a black cloth. And I am watching the future. The future is unknown, escaping from a threat and being trapped in another threat. Where is the safest place in the world? Where is the end of being a refugee?
Robert Mukombozi, can I bring you in here? You came to Australia on a humanitarian visa in 2009. Can you relate to that, that uncertainty, that sense of wondering about a future?
Without shattering, of course, your admiration of a country called Rwanda, being in the background of journalism and the profession of journalism, a very risky profession, we all know, especially a space of mine, which is war correspondence and investigations. Of course, it meant that in such a profession, if you are going to be very objective and fair, which is what is required of you by society to which you are a servant, you had to step on people's toes. And that's exactly what I did along the way. So in 2009, disagreed with my president on different issues, some of those being extrajudicial killings, disappearances. But of course, there's the other picture that we hardly talk about. And that's the human cost. And that human cost, if we mortgage it with development, then we tend to forget the fundamentals of the society that we are trying to build. And that was directly the case of Rwanda. And when we disagreed on that, attempts were made to assassinate me in the country, fled to Uganda, had to flee to Kenya. And in Kenya, fortunately, I was able to end up in Australia on humanitarian grounds. But of course, along that journey, one, you are fearful, your life at any time, you're either going to be poisoned or shot. Of course, the choices are very limited. And the fundamental choice you have, of course, is to hide as much as possible. But of course, like the journey of other people that Vicky Paris talked about, how to be categorized in different spaces to be able to end up in a humanitarian program, that's another journey altogether. At the most core of that conversation is the human cost. And that's the conversation that we tend to ignore. Of course, my journey is not an exception. And those are the fundamentals that we should be having a conversation on, other than the populist views that are tending to take the center stage, not just in Australia or Canada or the US, but globally. That's an uprising. And I think it's each and everyone's responsibility at this point to contribute as much as we can to the conversation in a sense that really focuses on the human cost, the resilience and the telling of stories, and make sure that we can use those stories of resilience and positive integration to be able to sell, not even selling, we shouldn't be selling, because at this point, we are all at least in a globalized setting where we should be understanding the constraints of the different communities, the numbers, because we tend to talk about 25 million seeking refugee spaces, some urgent, others non-urgent. I don't know how the non-urgent look like, but being in a camp for 38 years, I don't think that that's really fun. The moment we start having this conversation, focusing on the human cost of it, other than the populist views of trying to win an election and votes, I think that's the time that we are going to start having a meaningful conversation and a collective development agenda.
Vicky Reynolds, the focus on the human cost takes a brave politician. And if you look at the global landscape, two stand out, and that is German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Justin Trudeau in Canada. But it's been at a big political cost, hasn't it?
That's a pretty complicated question. Because I would say that Justin Trudeau isn't doing anything different than the last Prime Minister of Canada, actually, on many fronts. You know, he's just brought the military to go across sacred Indigenous territory to put a pipeline across the country. You know, so, and his Attorney General, who's an Indigenous woman, has just left because she's been pressured to not go bring the law to corporations that are funding him. You know, I think you just get the best politician you can get in, and then you fight them like hell to do the right thing. But I think Canada, like Australia, everybody who's not an Indigenous person came there on a boat, right? Or a plane. And so we're a land of immigrants and migrants and refugees. And so I think there's a groundswell of activism. I don't think it's on the part of good leadership. I think our Prime Minister is following the Canadian spirit, which is bring people. You know, I think, isn't that the second verse of the Australian anthem that says there's room for everybody or something? You know, like, no, but I think, you know, what you have to do is you have to, I think, as activists, we have to create enough momentum to let the leaders do the right thing. And I think that Justin Trudeau has been responding to some of that in terms of refugees and migrants in useful ways. Unfortunately, like all the Syrian refugees who came into Canada, I believe there was a bit of a bait and switch. So what happened is all kinds of money, we said we had all kinds of money for Syrian refugees, but what happened is all other refugee funding was cut and just moved over there. You know, it looks all good. You got to always be skeptical about where's the money, right? You know, I'm not a pessimist. I have a hopeful skepticism. I'm skeptical, but I'm hopeful. So like, we just have to keep on, and you have to track at whose cost, right? You know, it's great to be Canadian, but you know, there's a reason Canada and Australia have these affinities starting with, you know, I guess the other thing I think about is, in terms of that is, there hasn't been redress for political violence and torture of Indigenous people in residential schools. Until you heal that, you can't go do the next thing, you know? So, you know. I am very far to the left of any political party in Canada, though. So this is an normative Canadian. And I do think there's a sense of relief that this Prime Minister is willing and open. So that's where the hopeful part is.
Ray Gaiter, I guess in the absence of wider political leadership, what we are seeing is campaigning very much focused on rights and through illegal avenues. Certainly here in Australia last December, two class actions were filed in the High Court by the National Justice Project. And this is very much about the asylum seekers and refugees on Nauru and Manus Island. And the argument there is a legal argument that they've been subjected to torture and crimes against humanity. But I'm interested in exploring your thoughts about this, because I know that you've argued that this notion of putting rights at the centre of social conflicts takes the eyes off the real problem.
Well, that was Simone Weil's thought, actually, whom I quoted. The idea of human rights is not only a legal concept. I mean, it's very interesting. Like in the preamble to the Convention on Torture, for example, it talks about the inalienable dignity that's violated by torture. So there's an ethical dimension or a moral dimension. And most people are morally, not legally edified, when they talk about human rights and so on. I don't think the thought that a person's rights have been seriously violated, let's say if they're tortured or if they suffer the degradation that people suffer on Manus Island, can capture the moral terribleness of what they suffer. You can't capture the terribleness of what someone who has been badly wronged suffers by simply describing the physical and the psychological trauma. Because for them, the fact that they've been wronged and deeply wronged is an irreducible part of their torment. And that's partly what was captured in Vicky's poem. It's partly why Jean Amory said that a person who's tortured is never fully at home in the world again. it's not that I'm opposed to talk about rights, it's just that we need to keep anchoring talk of human rights in that much richer vocabulary of moral vocabulary, which reveals why in the end it's such a terrible thing to violate someone's human rights. And I think we're becoming increasingly illiterate in the moral vocabulary that we need to do that. And it's partly because people naturally think that if there's to be international law, it has to be very abstract, because it has, as it were, to prescind and abstract from the different cultures to which it applies. But I think what Robert was saying about conversation and the poem that Vicky read, I'd want to argue that we should think of a different kind of universality attached to law. If we think of the universality of great poetry or great film, or for example, it's all, let's say great poetry, it's always translated from one natural language into another. It's not put into Esperanto or some vague and abstract one. I think international law is so important because if you don't care about the wrongs that people in other nations suffer, the talk of a community of nations just becomes empty. If they are to understand the wrongs they suffer, it's going to be in their own natural languages, appealing to their own literature, their song and their poetry. And we have to become conversant. That's the idiom in which the conversation that Robert was speaking about has to be conducted, I think. But in the case, if I go to asylum seekers, I mean, sometimes I think it would be best to ditch talk of rights in certain contexts. I think we would understand what's going on with asylum seekers much better if we talked about obligation to need. This is one of Simone Weil's very important suggestions. Because if we ask ourselves a very simple question, how is it that some people on this earth have suffered the miseries of the damned and other people on this earth enjoy the fruits and benefits of the earth? If we start thinking again about who might go where with that very basic question, I think we'll get much further in answering it if we start thinking about the obligation that we have, obviously, to the need of asylum seekers, but also of the need that people in nations have to be rooted. And instead of then saying, we have the right to determine who comes here, you know, say in that belligerent tone, rights naturally leads to that. But if you're responsive to the needs of asylum seekers, and they're responsive too to the needs of people who have a particular culture, who've enjoyed its literature, its song, who would fight for it against a foreign conqueror, for example, then I think that we begin to understand much better what this conflict, or we put it in a much better ethical framework.
Paris Aristotle, sorry, go on.
I was going to say on that note, in my view, the one thing we have control over, which can get lost in a battle about rights and so forth, although I'm completely on board with the rights issue, but what seems to occur is, and it's what's happened in Australia, you've got this phenomenally complex issue where people are suffering in every kind of part of it at one level, and we reduce it down to a binary argument about, for example, well, you just want everybody to be able to come, or you just don't want anybody to be able to come, or you're happy for everyone to die at sea, or you're happy for everyone to be suffering in a different set of arrangements in our region. And it's just not that black and white. Like, it's so much more fundamentally complicated. I mean, we have had, and I think every agency here would also be working with asylum seekers whose trauma is deeply centred in how terrifying their experience of getting here was. I mean, that smugglers are somehow these heroes when actually they couldn't give a damn about the people, and it's kind of evidenced by the fact that 200 people would be put on a boat built for 20 with not a life jacket inside. So you have these kids that are in the water for 18 hours watching their fathers die and their brothers die and others, and we wonder how do we ignore that sort of stuff. But then the answer apparently, in this binary debate, is that we will control everything and we will place people here, and no matter how they are coping and how well they are doing, we somehow are able to utilise one terrible set of circumstances to justify another one, as if there's nothing in between, as if it's beyond our capability to do something different or better and take responsibility for doing something different or better in the region. And from my perspective, you brought up the panel earlier, that's what killed it. So instead of having a 30,000 place humanitarian program, instead of no one being in Nauru and Manus anymore, instead of having a regional framework that was protecting hundreds of thousands of people, no TPVs, no arbitrary detention, none of the kind of rubbish that we somehow are using to justify stopping the other terrible, horrendous event of people drowning at sea and being exploited by smugglers. Instead of having that, we've just got this binary debate with everybody trying to kick the daylights out of each other. And the people that suffer the most aren't the ones kicking the daylights out of each other. It's refugees and asylum seekers who desperately need the world's protection. And the reason why this argument and this issue, and I've run out of televisions from throwing things at people around these binary debates, and their failure to grasp the fact that we can do better, but we just have to take responsibility. If you don't want smugglers to take responsibility for it, then governments should take responsibility for putting something better in place as a genuine alternative.
But governments seem to have boxed themselves in a corner here in Australia, haven't they?
All over the world, they've boxed themselves in a corner. And, you know, it is all over the world. There are only different versions of terrible in operation today. There is not one country you can point to that is dealing with the question of asylum seekers decently and humanely. And I think, Robert, your point that I love is we can get caught up in a brawl about rights, and we need to have credible discussions about rights and so forth. They're fundamental. But there's one thing in all of this that we have control over, and it's not about the rights or about the strategy or whatever. It's simply how decently we treat people. That is entirely within our control. We don't control wars. We don't control global poverty. We don't control a whole range of the other factors. But we can choose to treat every single person humanely and with dignity, and in a morally sophisticated and supportive way. That is within our power and within our control to be able to do. And it doesn't mean you're going to have to give way to smuggling, or you have to open up more detention centres or anything like that.
On RN, this is Big Ideas with Paul Barclay.
Kathy Van Extel in conversation with Raymond Gaita, Vicky Reynolds, Robert Mukombozi, and Paris Aristotle. The suffering of refugees doesn't end once they arrive in a safe place. Many of them have to deal with deep-rooted trauma.
Robert Mukombozi, the terrible massacre in Christchurch has been described as a moment of reckoning in terms of the political discourse around Muslims and immigration. Is that how you see it?
I do sympathise with our colleagues in New Zealand and in particular Christchurch for the tragedy that they had to go through and endure. It was not supposed to be. It was not meant to be. And it's something that is appalling. But what it also brought to the fore, and here I would like to compare the reaction both in New Zealand and here in Australia, what we saw is great leadership. I think we all agree that the Prime Minister of New Zealand did exhibit excellent and outstanding leadership in handling this tragedy. And really, New Zealand showed us exemplary leadership in dealing with such tragedies of big, big proportion as the Christchurch incident was. But what we learned from that, and especially from such leadership, and the local community, not just in Christchurch, but across the globe. And here I'm not talking about just the Muslim community alone. I'm talking about mainstream Australians. I'm talking about mainstream New Zealanders. I'm talking about indigenous communities. The world came together to support our Muslim communities and support New Zealand. What we saw here in Australia was actually exceptional display of solidarity. So it brought the communities together. It reminded us that violence has no race, it has no color, it doesn't belong anywhere, and that violence is not the best way that we can deal with our diversity, and that our diversity is our biggest strength. So the communities came together, embraced each other. We worked very closely with our Muslim communities, and we've seen that what actually the person intended to do, which was to divide the community as wide as possible and advance the populist intention, actually fell through. And what we have now is a community that is very solid in its solidarity and unity. We've seen a community that has responded to extremism with compassion, and I think that's more of what we should be seeing in our communities. I hope that continues, and I'm pretty sure the community is moving on, is healing, and working together and stronger than before.
Vicky Reynolds, clearly New Zealand and Australia are very close, and there are huge ties. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how this has reverberated in the Northern Hemisphere, mm-hmm. and I guess how it might play into the supremacist argument over there.
Well, the truth is that I was in Australia when this happened. I've been here a bit, but I have many thoughts about this, and I'm in solidarity with a lot of people in the Muslim community, both in Canada, in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and in Vancouver. Sekna Hamid Beckett and I, she's a woman from Muslim tradition working in Sydney, I phoned her immediately to try to reach out to her, as I thought anyone should. And one of the things she said that I thought was so telling, brilliant, stark, dark, and terrifying was, "Vicky, you can't be surprised. No Muslim person was. It's a privilege, it's a site of privilege to be shocked by this in the state of Islamophobia in which we're moving." And so I think for me as a Canadian, I'm looking at, this could so easily have happened in Canada. It's not just rhetoric. Words actually do things, don't they? And so we have created the conditions with Islamophobia. And then the way that hate speech has gone on, institutional structures, government speaking in these ways that have actually created the conditions for this terrorism, right, for these murders. And now, of course, it's going to be talked about as if it's one white person. And again, psychology is going to show up as an enemy of justice and give you an excuse why this white person was mentally ill and why it happened. This is Islamophobia. So any tool, as punks say, hey, any tool is a weapon if you hold it right. So a diagnosis of mental illness can disguise fascism, white supremacy, Islamophobia. So I'm still reverberating with this and wondering about what's my response as a person who's non-Muslim. And you know, it's kind of like, welcome to the apocalypse. So many people have woken up to this, but there's people in marginalized locations, trans people, queer folks, indigenous people, have been, and all Muslim folks and refugees have been walking in this different territory in Aotearoa, New Zealand, in Canada. You know, how many wake-up calls do we need before we get it, that this is not an anomaly? This is actually the emergence of a lack of morality that led to these events. This isn't isolated. This isn't mental illness. This is what it looks like, what we're building.
Ray Gaita, the Australian Prime Minister spoke about the need for the end of tribalism. Do you have any faith that we can achieve that?
You have to remind me what he meant by that.
Well, it was about the heat of debate and the two tribes, you know, being too far apart. I'm not quite sure what sort of evidence we've seen of any change in the conversation. It's probably been toned down a little.
Vicky said she's far to the left of probably any electable party in Canada. And I think the truth of these sort of situations would I know this might make sound arrogant, but I think a truthful perception of these situations would make anybody to the left of any electable party. And one of the things one has to resist here is the constant movement to the centre. They even call it the sensible centre. For example, abandon universities. I'm not now on the politically correct bandwagon, but I remember when I was at university, people were calling for revolution. If you were in a university now calling for a revolution, and even arguing maybe that there should be, here I disagree with you, unless you're a pacifist, sometimes you'll think there has to be violence. And that was the discussion, and in those cases, of course, on the left. And now there are so many watchdogs in universities where any student society that argued that maybe there ought to be a workers' revolution or any other kind of revolution would soon be cut out of the universities. So to argue what I think would effectively amounts to a truthful perception, let's say, of the plight of Indigenous peoples, who I think... one ought to think of as not legally but morally under occupation. If there was a truthful discussion under what conditions Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians could say, we in truthful political fellowship, what kind of we that would be, then I think it ought not to be out of the question that we'd have to change the name of the country and no longer call it Australia, if there were to be what we call truthful reconciliation. But if you think about the discussion, let's say even about changing the date of Australia Day, you can see how far we are from any such possibility. So I think one of the things we really have to fight against is the coercive discussion of the sensible centre in politics.
I think time's against us, I'm afraid, but I do have a question for Paris just to finish up with, and it goes back to what we're talking about right at the beginning, Paris, that we need to acknowledge that people who come here on humanitarian visas to re-establish their lives here in Australia do so with an enormous amount of courage and resilience. I'm wondering whether, as a nation, we do enough to acknowledge and celebrate that, and whether that will help with some of those fissures?
I'm not sure we do. I think we try, and there are agencies in this room who do absolutely extraordinary work, not just torture and trauma services, but settlement services. There are medical professionals here who work in different areas of medicine and so forth that do absolutely extraordinary work, both in terms of support for people, but also in recognising and assisting people to re-establish themselves here. Even more importantly is that there's a room here full of people who've been through the refugee experience, who are unequivocally and undeniably making an extraordinary contribution to this country and making it better than it was before they came here. But I don't think we do enough in that. We make it tough for people who have been qualified overseas to get their qualifications recognised here in Australia. You know, there are surgeons and doctors and engineers and teachers and lawyers and plumbers and electricians and a whole range of professions that people carved a life and built an identity around that in Australia. We haven't really made it easy for them to resume that and go on to continue to create that. I think there are things we can do to help ease that transition. And it's not because you're a refugee, it's because moving to another country is just bloody difficult. Not to mention whether you're distressed about family that have been left behind or your difficulties with learning the language and ability to communicate. I think on all of those levels, Australia is recognised internationally as being a world leader. But that doesn't mean there isn't a hell of a lot more that we couldn't do or that we shouldn't be encouraged to do and that we shouldn't be doing that in a way which really what we're promoting is the fact that our humanitarian program, on the one hand, is a terrific gesture towards trying to alleviate some suffering somewhere. But really, we are all better off. Like the humanitarian program, like most migration programs, as much and in the end more about our benefit and our prosperity as a nation than it is in that first act of saying, yes, we do want to have a situation where we rescue people from terrible, terrible circumstances. You know, 3 million people in protracted situations for 38 years or more, a third generation of children born into displacement. We can do better. Australia proves that it can be done. There, in 30 years, and I know from beyond that, no matter where somebody has come from, no matter where what their experiences have been, no matter what their religious background or whatever, I have never not seen the country by and large able to embrace people and for the country not to be able to be better off as a result of it. So why don't we do more? And why don't we find ways where together, instead of giving up hope and spending our time in this pitched battle over this much of the issue, open ourselves up to what the real challenges are, including how it links into other areas and domains, and appreciate that we are stronger for it, better for it, and that's how we should pursue it into the future.
Robert Mukombozi, you very much work within... Robert Mukombozi, you very much work at that community level. In terms of, I guess, that engagement, are you seeing a receptiveness to that message about what people who settle here can offer to the Australian society?
The panelists talked about resilience, they talked about the positive stories of settlement, but they also talked about the difficult journeys and the different models that we do apply in terms of responding to the needs of refugees and migrants who've experienced especially torture and trauma prior to migrating to Australia. But when you go down to the community, and of course we do acknowledge that there are ongoing ethical and moral distress situations where we know what to do, but of course there are institutional constraints around what we should be doing in the communities that we work with. Regardless of that layer of institutional constraints, you see that the best practical models of responding to community growth are really making great impact. In this journey of great impact, of course, we are not just talking about recovery. Of course, there is the clinical approach. And then, of course, there's family interventions, and then on a wider scale, community response. And what we are seeing is that there are so many positive stories, settlement stories along the way of someone who came with that qualification, like Paris talked about. At some point, the qualification was either acknowledged or not acknowledged, but to that one whose qualifications has been acknowledged, the doctors, the engineers, the pilots that you're seeing in our communities today. And those individuals act as role models to the rest of their respective communities and to Australia at large. Of course, they make us proud as our representatives when we have sporting events, whether locally or overseas. We've seen that, but also in other sectors and disciplines. So what we are seeing is a story of communities actually responding positively. But of course, that's not to say, like I mentioned, with the institutional constraints and the moral pressures and distress on the services, that they are, of course, individuals, families and communities and are still struggling. But working collectively, of course, we will all achieve better results.
On that note, we'll wrap up the conversation. Thank you to our panellists. It's been a wonderful conversation.
A discussion on trauma and torture with Raymond Gaita, Vicky Reynolds, Robert Mukombozi, and Paris Aristotle, moderated by RN's Cathy Van Extel. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.